Hello and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast with me, Robin, and Alex, and Martin. Hello, 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 and welcome to this episode in which we shall be discussing and revealing, in fact, facts about your favourite movies that you probably didn't know. So each of us have declared our favourite movies, or yes, movies plural, I think, definitely, in Alex and mine's case. And we've each assigned those movies to one another, and we're going to try to surprise each other with facts about our favourite movies, as well as disclosing some hopefully fascinating and unusual factoids about films of yours, dear listeners, that you might enjoy. And so, gentlemen, before we begin, of course, we shall be responding to your comments, and I'll be sharing a riddle with you both, but I want to know how you both are before I do that. So how are you both? Martin?
Yeah, no, very well, I think. What's there to say? I mean, I've actually put up some Halloween decorations already in the house. So we've got a neon sign over to my right that says, eek, eek. That's in the window. So that's good. And what else have we got? We've got some lights around the window, got a happy Halloween thing. Oh, we've got a door knocker on the door that's really loud. And it goes, oh, welcome to the House of Horror. So that's all fun. So that's been kind of the activity over the last 24 hours. It's been keeping me busy, getting these decorations up.
That sounds very, very exciting, Martin. Have you carved a pumpkin?
No, I went pumpkin picking with the kids at the weekend.
Nice.
Oh, that is so wholesome.
Picked up a few. Lovely. I know, right? I know. So that was good. I think we'll carve that. Anyway, that's my week. What about you, Alex?
I'm good. Yeah, getting in the Halloween mood as well. Whilst we're on the subject of films, I guess it's worth putting it out there. What's both of your favourite Halloween films? What's your spooky season films that really get you in the Halloween mood? I'm quite partial to a bit of Hocus Pocus.
Oh, nice.
But also just like, what, maybe just some like classic horror films or something.
It's a tough answer because I find it very hard to pick favorites, and I have a kind of collection of go-to films. But yeah, I lean more towards your gothic horrors. So I guess a recent favorite of mine for Halloween, getting the mood, is Sleepy Hollow with John Burton, that's a good one. Because especially with the famous moment of him throwing the pumpkin into the camera.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's a good bit of Halloween fare for me. I also enjoy, if I'm in a... My wife hates horror films. She can't stand them, can't deal with them. She gets they're too much for her. So I try to find some more family-friendly horror films such in the animated sphere, like Paranorman. Like her a few years ago.
Okay.
And obviously Coraline's a good one.
Yeah, Coraline, seen that.
The Nightmare Before Christmas, I still cannot decide whether it's a Halloween movie or a Christmas movie.
I was going to say, does that count?
Christmassy, isn't it, surely?
Yeah. I don't think you could, I don't think that... I would class that as a Christmas film, even though it's...
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, it starts on Halloween night, doesn't it? And then goes into Christmas, so it's a post-Halloween film. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, the ones that immediately came to mind for me are Shaun of the Dead, so a comedy, comedy ripoff. I love Shaun of the Dead.
That's a great film, though.
And then I do like some horror. I've seen a few horror movies, but I don't. It's quite rare that I'm like, oh, I'm really in the mood to just sit down and watch horror on my own. Because similarly to you, Robin, my wife's not big on the old horror, and so the closest I get to it really is kind of the scary episodes of like Inside Number 9. which I love.
Yeah.
So I put on a few episodes of that, which is just great.
You reminded me, that's a good one. When I remember, it's always fun to put on the Simpsons Halloween special.
Oh, yeah.
Those are very Halloween-y.
The Treehouse of Horror, right?
Yeah. Yes, that's it. Yeah. Treehouse of Horror.
But I guess that's worth asking the audience, what are your favourite Halloween films to get you in the mood of spooky season?
I've got a riddle for you both. It's not very scary, but it might be a bit creepy.
Okay.
So, question is, the riddle is, I make two people out of one. What am I? So, any thoughts? First, any instincts, anything kind of grabbing you?
I mean, I think you just went straight to Adam and Eve. God.
I reckon, what? I reckon that could be the answer. Robin did say it was a bit of a stupid one this week. I could see that being the answer, Martin. But didn't you say it was a bit spooky?
Well, the question's kind of creepy, maybe.
Could it be Could it be a midwife delivering twins? It's not quite make, is it?
Yeah,
it's more a take two people out of one as opposed to make two people out of one.
And that's not how that works. Yeah. You don't like you don't get two people and trade in another one.
Okay. No, well, I shall reveal the answer at the end of the episode. In the meantime, please feel free to guess in the comments below on YouTube or send us your thoughts by any other means if you're listening to us on a podcast platform of your choice. We're on Twitter at JInterestingYT, or I'm at All Time Robin.
I'm at Just Alexing.
And I'm at Mart Interesting.
Ha-ha! So, speaking of your comments, any comments, fellas, that we'd like to respond to this week?
I've gone from Michael Bailawager. Okay. Yeah, it's just a whole lot of letters at the end there, so apologies. It might even be your surname, I'm not reading it properly. And then 3278, Michael Bailawager. Hopefully that's right, Michael. Apologies if I got that wrong. Michael writes, the Textrodotoxin in pufferfish has also been linked to the zombie folklore in Haiti.
Ooh.
Interesting. It is hypothesized tetrodotoxin.
Tetrodotoxin or something. Yeah. It's a difficult word to say.
Tetrodotoxin. Yes, you're right. In non-lethal amounts, slows the heart rate and breathing to a point that one appears to be dead. Compounds employed by witch doctors containing tetrodotoxin, among other substances, are used to convince a victim that they have in fact died and the witch doctor has raised them as a zombie.
Ooh.
Interesting. Quite Halloween-y as well. I like that.
That is very Halloween-y. That's something I'm...
Zombie folklore.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I should look into that.
Well, you're going to get it as like your Halloween, part of your Halloween costume.
Yeah, I'm going to get a bit of this really and freak you guys out dead. And just die. Yeah, very briefly and then come back from the dead. I'll find it on the dark web, I'm sure. It's fine.
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
It'll be fine.
Well, I've got a comment, speaking of Halloween, from Microtech 5871, who says, are you guys going to do a live Halloween show like last year? Also, I'll be sure to send my Halloween story early this time, assuming, of course, you'll be reading viewers' stories. Well, unfortunately, as you may have guessed, given when you're watching this, we're not going to be talking about Halloween stories, because I feel like we've done that over the last few years, and this year, just thought we'd do something a little bit different. However... And unfortunately, due to scheduling conflicts, it wasn't possible to do this before or on Halloween. But we will be doing a slightly belated Halloween-themed live quiz sometime this week. So stick around. Make sure you've got the notifications on YouTube. Because in the days after Halloween, we'll be doing a Halloween-themed live quiz. So yes,
Halloween only ends when you feel like it's ended inside.
I mean, I love Halloween. Exactly. It's one of the best times of year. So I feel like let's keep the good times rolling. You know, Christmas as soon as October 31st leaves, Christmas is right there, and I feel like let's push it back a little bit.
Well, I
agree. Yeah,
I'd say we've at least got a few days in after Halloween for the UK. Viewers for Bonfire Night, Guy Fawkes Night.
That's
right?
True, yeah, very true.
November the 5th, that's often a big one. Usually the weekend after, sometimes the weekend before, there's a fireworks, aren't there, all around the place?
Yeah.
That's kind of next on the calendar. But then, we're talking, as soon as you get to mid-November, it's right into Christmas, isn't it?
Big time.
Oh, actually, talking of Christmas, just to diverge slightly, I'm the first mince pie today.
Disgusting. Oh. Despicable.
No, disgraceful.
Halloween.
I know, I felt ashamed.
I've got a comment from History of M 8586, who commented on a couple of episodes ago, the richest people who ever lived.
Ooh.
And I think we asked our listeners and viewers, what would you do if you were the richest person who ever lived, or if you suddenly became a billionaire overnight?
I think it was if Elon Musk went to Mars and left you with all of his money.
Yes.
What would you do?
The very specific question. Yeah. What would you do with Elon Musk's money? And History of M says, I'd buy houses and charge rent and rent them out at just above the property tax. The surplus would go to a repair fund for the properties, and I'd also invest a chunk and redistribute the growth of that fund with my tenants, and then me and my descendants would live comfortably on the rest for eons.
There we go.
Interesting.
Very thoroughly thought out.
I will just say you don't actually have to do any of that, and you and your descendants could still live comfortably for eons.
Yeah.
But I guess you would lower the rental costs in an area across the board? Is that the aim?
Maybe, yeah. Mm. It says rent you the disrupt, mountain just above the property tax.
Disrupt sure the you disrupt the housing market and maybe make things better for the cost of living, I guess. I guess that's okay, so, noble aims.
Or are they saying rent out just above your own property tax? So you're covering your tax.
Okay.
But you're not charging in much in excess of that.
So you are keeping it low. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like
that's good. Yeah.
Like rent control.
Mm. Yeah.
I guess that's pretty good. Although I feel like you, with Elon Musk's money, the man's gone to Mars. You can be more ambitious. You don't just have to do that, you know. Build 1 million houses and build them like 30,000 feet tall or something, you know. Do something wild.
Do what Mansa Musa, is that his name?
Yeah, Mansa Musa. Yeah.
Mansa Musa, do what he did and just devalue houses by building 10 million of them.
Oh, yeah. Elon Musk's money. Totally. Yeah. They're giving them away.
Crash the housing market. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, gentlemen, would you like to talk about movie facts behind your favorite movies?
Oh, yes.
Ooh, facts about your favorite films. Well, I thought we'd start us up with just a quick fact, a nice little kind of warm-up that I learned just the other day, actually. I was watching a documentary about Roger Moore, and I thought I'd bring this fact because I have to justify why I'm wearing this T-shirt, obviously.
And, oh, nice.
Apparently, he hated guns, was not a fan of guns.
Oh.
So he was very reluctant. Okay. He wasn't reluctant to play James Bond because he liked money, but he was reluctant to do all the gun stuff with James Bond because he disapproved very strongly of guns. So as part of his taking on the role, he thought, right, I've got to overcome my problem with guns. Because it wasn't just that he hated them. He had a kind of fear of them from a childhood incident. He was shot with a BB gun by some bullies. So he just didn't like guns. So he thought, I'm going to overcome my fear of guns. I've got to learn how to use them for the role. So he went to a shooting range and they gave him a revolver. But didn't realize, or the people training him didn't realize, that there was something wrong with the revolver.
Oh, no.
And on the first shot, it exploded in his hands.
Oh, my God.
What? It's not great for a person who has fear of guns, is it?
No, exactly. So luckily he wasn't injured, but he just toughed it out over the years playing James Bond. He just toughed it and just pretended everything was fine. But he still had a fear of guns, even late into his life, apparently.
I wonder if you did some calculations and you're like, okay, how many gun scenes are there? How many shots does Roger Moore fire versus?
Oh, yeah.
Because like, I've got a vivid, well, I've seen a lot of James Bond, but a lot of vivid memories of Pierce Brosnan especially firing a lot of bullets.
Yeah, that's true.
He loves a good machine gun. And you think of Roger Moore, you're like freezing with, you know, the iconic, you know, pose. But actually, how many shots does he fire?
Well, does he use a machine gun in The Spy Who Loved Me in the big battle?
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yes, let's go into, we've got Martin's favourite movie has been nominated as, declared officially, you heard it here first, folks, The Blues Brothers.
Yeah, yeah. And not the best film, but one that has everything, and I just enjoy watching it over and over again.
It's a popular one as people's favorite films go, though. I think it's
a good choice.
Lots of people would say that it's their favorite film because they say it's got a bit of everything in it, hasn't it? It's got like everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Alex's favorite films.
Oh, it could only be there, surely.
Yeah.
The amount I go on.
If you haven't
about
guessed already, long-term listeners of the podcast will know it's Fast and Furious.
I'm
the whole franchise, aren't we? The whole thing.
I just want to preface. I probably wouldn't actually say that they're my favorite films, but I feel like it would be funny. I'm curious to see what you guys have come up with facts about them.
Good.
Yeah.
And then I've declared my favorite films to be Indiana Jones, all five of them. Go for it. Go nuts.
Yeah, Alex, you've got Indiana Jones. I've got The Fast and Furious. And Robin has got Blues Brothers. That's where we're at, yeah.
That is correct, yes. So the first fact that I've got for you, Robin, and I don't know, the thing is, this is the most difficult one because I know that you will know all of these facts already. So, yeah, I'm not necessarily sure. Okay. Well, did you know that there was another actor who was offered the role of Indiana Jones? Yeah, okay, you already know. Go on, tell me. Who was it?
Are you going to tell me it's Mr. Mustache himself?
It's Mr. Mustache himself, yeah. Tom Selleck was offered the role as Indiana Jones. However, CBS wouldn't let him take the role because he'd already shot the Magnum PI pilot for the network. But that's crazy to think that...
So cruel.
To think that in an alternate reality, Indiana Jones was Tom Selleck. Do you think he could have done the role justice, Robin?
So... Over the years, I've actually come to like Tom Selleck quite a bit. And I think I like him as for who he is. But he's not Indiana Jones. No way. And it's just so weird to think that Spielberg was willing to make that whole movie with Tom Selleck. It just seems wrong. Because he did make his own.
I think he would have been great. He's Magnum P.I.
I mean, he's great. Yeah. I like him a lot. But he's not Indiana Jones, you know. But he did make a movie in, I think I want to say it's 1985, called High Road to China, which is kind of his Indiana Jones movie. And that's fun, and he's good in that, but he's not Indiana Jones.
Okay, well, speaking of actors who were nearly in the films, did you know that a certain Matilda / It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia actor nearly made it into the films?
As Sala, yeah?
As Sala, really? Yes. I'm talking, of course, about Danny DeVito. Was nearly played the role of Sala. Again, this wasn't just like he showed an interest or made it to the final stages. He was offered the role.
Oh my gosh.
And while he expressed interest in it, his agent wanted more money and he faced scheduling conflicts with his sitcom Taxi, which was airing. And in the end, Rhys Davies was ultimately cast.
Now that really would have changed things, I think. Danny DeVito in Indiana Jones. That's just a completely different take on the character.
Yeah, that would have been different. So Tom Selleck and Danny DeVito were nearly some of the titular characters in the franchise.
I can't picture that in a good way. No.
Here's another one for you, Robin, that you'll definitely know. Hmm. Pop quiz. Where does the name Indiana come from?
It's George Lucas's dog, isn't it?
Yeah, it's George Lucas's dog. Yeah.
You were named after the dog.
George Lucas owned an Alaskan Malamute named Indiana, which was where he got his namesake from. Interestingly enough, his real life dog also served as the inspiration for Chewbacca in Star Wars. So there's a weird situation where.
Disservice to that dog.
Where. Harrison Ford played Indiana Jones, who was named after George Lucas's dog, and was, you know, alongside Chewbacca, who was also inspired by George Lucas's dog. So that dog. That like iconic, one of the most iconic duos in cinema, you could say, were just inspired by George Lucas's dog.
You must have really liked the dog.
What an amazing dog.
Got a lot of fond memories about that dog. Yeah. That's genius, isn't it? That's just taking your pet and turning it into two multi-billion-dollar franchises. That's how you do it.
It's all it takes. Yeah.
This was an interesting one. Did you know, well, in The Last Crusade obviously features a lot of Nazis in Nazi uniforms.
Yes.
But did you know that they were actually real Nazis? No, they weren't. They weren't. But they were.
That was really, you shot me there.
But they were real Nazi uniforms.
Were they?
Did you know that?
Okay.
The costume designer Anthony Powell explained in the Last Crusade documentary, making of documentary, that the Nazi uniforms worn by hundreds of extras in the film were genuine. We had a lot of Nazis in the film. All of those uniforms, I think, were genuine ones that I found in Eastern Europe somewhere.
Somewhere. Collection.
It's kind of suspicious, isn't it? That's
This old, very, very, very veteran Russian soldier's got this giant shed full of uniforms.
Yeah.
Like, oh, and where did you get all these uniforms from, Vlad? Don't ask. You don't want to know.
Also, in the same making of documentary, there was an interesting bit regarding the rats that were used. Have you heard about this, Robin?
Is this about they were bred specially for the film?
Oh, my God, yeah. Why do I bother?
No.
2,000 rats were bred for just that, like, one sequence in The Last Crusade.
That's astonishing.
So that's where they go beneath in the library and crack through the...
In the catacombs.
Yeah.
He's confronted with thousands of rats, And in this documentary, Spielberg explained, in order to have rats that aren't infected with some virus or disease, you have to basically cultivate them from living births. So animal handlers gave birth to something like 2,000 living rats. Yeah. Crazy, right?
Fair play. I never do just kill them all.
Do you know what? I don't know. I don't know. And
donated them to science.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you know that there is a scene in the film with Sean Connery and Harrison Ford where neither of them are wearing any trousers?
Yes, the Zeppelin scene, isn't it?
Oh, for goodness sake, Robin. Yeah. In fairness, I should pretend
at least to be surprised.
All of these are from the documentary, which I'm guessing you've watched about it.
A few times, yeah.
A few times. So the passengers in the scene were wearing fur coats and hats. It was supposed to be wintertime, and Sean Connery decided to wear it without any trousers because the scene's shot from their waist up. And Harrison Ford said to him, "You're not going to play the scene with your trousers?" And Sean Connery said, "If I don't, I'll be stopping all the time because I sweat enormously. I sweat very easily." And Harrison Ford thought that was a great idea. And it's like, yeah, I'll join in.
You should read that in the Sean Connery voice, Alex. Can you do that for us?
Well, if I don't, I'll be stopping all the time because I sweat enormously. I sweat very easily.
I'd love to see the wide shot of that. I'd just be like, it's so funny.
Well, you'll have to tell me, Robin. Do you know if that wide shot exists somewhere? Or have you never seen that?
I've never seen. You would hope that there was a... Because they, you know, take promotional stills for a lot of these things.
Yeah, you'd
I've
think
I've never
someone
seen that.
Would,
Maybe it's in someone's private collection somewhere.
Yeah, perhaps.
I was going to say, that's similar to the well-known fact about Star Wars, Episode 4, A New Hope. I know you love that film, Alex.
Love it, with Peter Cushing,
who plays the evil Grand Moff Tarkin. And the costumes for the first Star Wars film were obviously like scrambled together because the budget was fairly tight. So Peter Cushing, who plays this evil Imperial officer, is wearing, in the wide shots, these very tight leather riding boots. You know, look very imperious. Mm-hmm. But because they were just grabbed from whatever costume store, they didn't actually fit properly and they're very tight. And they were found very uncomfortable. So for all the scenes where you can't see his feet, he's just wearing these furry slippers.
Yeah,
he found them more comfortable.
Nice. Fair play. Yeah.
Did you know in the Well of Souls scene, well, how many snakes do you think they had in that scene?
Oh, good question. I'm going to go out there, say 1,000.
A thousand. That seems like it would be enough, right? You know?
You'd think
that would be plenty. They had apparently between 8,000 and 10,000 snakes in that scene.
That's crazy.
Which I wonder, how do they keep track of them all? Like if they brought in different animal handlers.
Which one's yours?
Which one's yours? I suppose maybe
they just don't care.
Maybe they're just like
rounding up all those snakes, yeah.
Maybe it's just like as long as they leave with the same number.
Oh, man. There's definitely at least a few hundred snakes that got away. They're out in the wild now.
Did you know, another one, that the iconic boulder scene wasn't initially designed to be... It wasn't going to be as big of a set piece as it ended up being. But Steven Spielberg, when he visited the set, fell in love with like the look of it. And asked them to extend the set by another 50 feet. So it was quite a big alteration.
Yeah.
By doing that, the audience was given the time that it needed to witness this imminent danger that Indy was in. I think the scene wouldn't have been what it was if he hadn't. It wasn't originally designed to be as long as it was. You know.
That's amazing, yeah, because that is truly iconic. That's an amazing moment, yeah. Funny to think it was going to be shorter.
It's what people think about, right? If you say Indiana Jones, you think the hat, the whip, the boulder.
Okay, maybe. One final quick fact for you, Robin. What was Indiana Jones originally called?
I could tell you, but...
No, go on, tell me.
You should tell me.
No, go on.
Indiana Smith.
Yeah, it's an awful name, isn't it? That's like...
It's funny, isn't it?
Indiana Smith.
Especially if you just imagine George Lucas saying it, like, Indiana Smith.
So, of course, that was George Lucas's George Lucas's plan, and he was discussing the story ideas with Spielberg, and he was referring to the protagonist as Indiana Smith, and Spielberg wasn't impressed and said, "How about Indiana Jones?" And the rest, as they say, was history. Yeah,
it is amazing how much better it works.
It does. It does work better, but then we are used to it.
Yeah,
I wonder if it was happened to be called Indiana Smith, you'd just be like, well, that's what it's called.
Yeah, maybe.
It's a bit like, rubbish band names. You're like, well, they're just called that. It's not a particularly good band name, but we all know them as that. Is this a fact? I mean, Robin, you might be able to tell me, but somewhere from the back of my brain,
yeah,
there's the sequence, you know, where there's the guy with the swords, like, does all the crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And then Indiana Jones just pulls out the gun and shoots him, right?
Yes.
And was there meant to be a battle or fighting sequence there, but Indiana Jones got like a food poisoning, was like shitting everywhere,
yeah,
like 2 days before it.
And yeah, so, it was dysentery. Everyone had dysentery.
Oh, God.
Yeah, the whole set, I think. Yeah, all the crew.
Yeah, they did do a couple of takes. I think there was some behind the scenes footage of, as in the one brief snippet of footage of the stuntman doing the original planned fight.
Okay.
But they only did it for one or two takes, and Harrison Ford was just like, can't do this. Why not just shoot him? Yeah. Which is a shame because that was a stuntman's big moment.
Apparently
been rehearsing
for
months.
But it's also really good.
You know, oh, it's amazing. Yeah, so good. yeah, good fact that. Good fact. And thank you, Alex, for all those facts. Those are
brilliant.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Hopefully, I mean, I didn't catch Robin out, but I never was going to. But hopefully there's...
some stuff I didn't know.
It's nice of you to pretend, Robin, but... hopefully there's something in there that you might not have realised about Indiana Jones.
Yes, but before we get on to my facts about Fast and Furious, hello.
Yes.
Should we go for some other movie facts to break things up a little bit?
Sure.
Just some, a potluck, shall we say,
of
other movie facts.
An amuse-bouche, a little palate cleanser.
I like it.
Ooh, I like it.
Rather, I've got one.
Okay.
Well, I've got a few more than one, but I'll start with one. And this one is from Shawshank Redemption. Morgan Freeman's character, Red, is described in the novella as being a white Irishman.
Mm.
And then in the movie, the script sees Red sarcastically quip, "Maybe it's because I'm Irish," as a nod to this change.
yeah.
That's cool. Is that why it's called Red?
Right,
it's because it's got red hair or something?
I would imagine so. I haven't actually read the novella.
I think that makes sense. That is where it comes from. Because then he's like, why did they call you Red in the film, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's like, maybe it's because I'm Irish. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so much funnier coming from Morgan Freeman than it would be. Just
that's the reason, right?
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
On a slightly different note, I've got a fact about the 2002 Sam Raimi Spider-Man film.
Perfect. The original, Spider-Man 1.
Yeah.
Good, cool.
Do you remember the scene in the cafeteria? This fact actually blew me away. I couldn't believe it was real. The bit in the cafeteria where Mary Jane trips over and her like food flies everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then Peter Parker catches the tray and then all of the food. That wasn't CGI or wasn't like...
That's mental.
Anything. They just kept doing it until Tobey Maguire got the take.
Actually did it. It's incredible.
Apparently it took 156 takes, but he actually...
What?
And apparently they glued the tray to his hand. And some say the tray is still glued to Tobey Maguire's hand to this day. But but then he actually did the thing where he caught all the food and moved the tray around. I just think like that's insane.
Yeah.
So crazy. So cool.
Fair play for having the perseverance, not just, I don't know, smashing the tray on the floor.
Yeah.
Or on your face because it's glued to your hands.
But also like on everyone on the set to still believe that he could do it. I mean, after you've done it 50 times and you're not even close. Like, when do you throw in the towel with that kind of thing and say, right, we'll do it in post? But the fact that he just kept doing it until he got it.
I think so. That's what separates the great directors, doesn't it? Sometimes it's that. Well, like you said, that fact about Spielberg's going to the set designers and saying, "This looks great. Can you make it longer by 50 feet?"
And then
they
love
Sam Raimi being like, "We're going to do it till we get it in camera." And it's the difference between a director who's just like, "Yeah, it's unfair to make people work even harder for this, and the directors who are like, we're going to get it this way. Mm. And that can be, that can make all the difference between a great, great moment or a great film. And
you got this, Tobey Maguire. Mm. Well, there's going to be no CGI in this film. You are Spider-Man. Okay? Here's your web slinger. Go and jump off a building. You got this. I believe in you.
First thing the director says is, so can we get a radioactive spider to bite him? Can we do that? You know, that's not how it works. Yeah.
Nice.
So, Sam, what Fast and Furious facts have we got, Martin?
Fast and Furious, okay. So, Alex.
Yes.
It's a pretty big franchise, so it kind of, I've dotted around a little bit here, but...
I also just want to preface this and say, I do not know the series as Robin knows Indiana Jones, so...
And I'm not going to quiz you on it because I would definitely 100% come unstuck with the Blues Brothers. Yeah. Love the film. Don't know anything about any of the behind the scenes or anything. Yeah, so anyway. Okay. So Fast and Furious, the original, the Fast and the Furious.
Thank you, yes.
It was directed by Rob Cohen. Mm. And he, if we just go back to the beginning, he got the idea of the film from an article from the late 90s in Vibe. About illegal street racing in New York City. So originally, actually, Fast and Furious was meant to be set in New York, and then it changed to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But anyway, this particular article focused on an unidentified racer called Racer X, very original. And Rob Cohen went to go and watch a whole load of illegal street races in Los Angeles and thought, I want to make a film movie about this, combining the illegal street racing scene with the adventures of Racer X, and that's how Fast and the Furious was originally developed.
And then I imagine he was like, now what's the story going to be about? And then he went and saw Point Break and was like, I know.
Hold on a second. Yeah. Well, do you know, Alex, what the movie was originally going to be called, the original Fast and the Furious? I don't.
The Slow and the Weary.
It wasn't. It was Red Line.
Okay,
Red Line, okay. Red Line, Red Line to Red Line, Red Line Tokyo Drift. I can't think of any others.
Then it's just Red Line.
Then it's just Red Line again. Yeah.
Then it'll be like Red 5, Line 6,
Red Line 7. Yeah.
Red of the Furious. No, it doesn't make Red of the Line.
Red Line presents.
Yeah.
Hobbs and Shaw.
I guess it would still be Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah, that wouldn't change.
So a little bit about the casting of the movie as well. So Paul Walker, of course, sadly, tragically passed away.
Yeah.
And he played Brian, which is a great name for a protagonist in a car movie, isn't it? Brian. But do you know who originally they were rumoured to have wanted, the studio wanted, to play Brian at the time of the first movie?
I'm trying to think of actors at that time.
Or maybe think less of actors and think more of musicians that did a bit of acting around the time.
Oh, no, I wouldn't get it then, in that case.
It was
Eminem. Oh, wow, okay.
Because he was currently producing, filming 8 Mile at the time.
Right, yeah.
And so they were like, okay, this guy could potentially act. We need a white, whiny guy. Let's go after Eminem. And so he turned it down, of course.
Yeah.
And then of course they approached Paul Walker. But yes,
It's crazy to think of the alternate history, because I guess if it was Eminem, I mean, I'm not saying Eminem wouldn't have been able to pull it off, but there is, I think, the heart and soul of the Fast and Furious franchise is actually kind of like in those initial films, the Paul Walker, Vin Diesel, you know, bromance,
the chemistry. Yeah, exactly.
And Paul Walker does a lot of the heavy lifting there, so I don't know if that would work with Eminem.
He does a lot of the heavy lifting, and also he's an enthusiast, isn't he? He's a car enthusiast, someone that loves cars.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's even true for
to the
Eminem.
End. Yeah.
Exactly, but obviously a car enthusiast. Whereas not all of the cast were. And Jordana Brewster, who plays Mia Toretto, and Michelle Rodriguez, who plays Letty Ritz.
Yeah.
Sure, you know these characters incredibly well.
Very well. Yeah.
Yeah. Neither of them had driver's licenses when they were first cast.
But surely that's part of the street racing underground. They don't obey the rules of the license.
Yeah. But unfortunately, they did for filming. So they had to go out and get their licenses with some intense lessons and pass before they'd be brought on board.
Fair enough. Well, I'm trying to think. I don't even know if they... Well, I don't think the character who plays... The actor, actress who plays Mia drives in the first film. I think Michelle Rodriguez does.
I imagine that you'd have to drive to get to work.
Los
Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, no, pretty crazy that you're doing a car movie and you can't even drive.
Very true. Very true.
Lots of famous cars, of course, like the Nissan Skyline, incredibly famous and made more so by this film. But it was the Volkswagen Jetta that Jesse drives in the first Fast and Furious movie.
Right, okay.
That was purchased by none other than Frankie Muniz.
What? Really?
Malcolm.
From Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so he bought it, I think, in the late... What's the word? The late noughties. Up until 2010. Yeah, I think it's like the...
The noughties.
Around 2010 he bought it. And he sold it again in 2015. But apparently Muniz is an absolute car enthusiast. And now apparently he's a professional driver and a street racing enthusiast.
Oh, yeah,
which
I have no
idea about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that at all. I just thought he was still like Malcolm in the Middle, but growing up a bit.
That almost feels more like a Frankie Muniz fact, but I'll
allow it. Oh, yeah. Nice. Indeed, true.
But no, I love Malcolm in the Middle as well, so fair enough.
Malcolm in the Middle was good, wasn't it? Now, Hal. The Hal character was brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, little did they know that he would go on to play so much more serious roles.
What's weird about his role from Hal to Walter in Breaking Bad is just kind of like... It's almost like the same premise. Basically, he's like an American family man, dad, who works at like a job that he's not happy with.
That's true.
Wears tighty whities. For some reason, that's just a thing that he has to do with all his characters.
Yeah. And actually, the car crossover, he was in Drive, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, of course. He was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ryan Gosling. Is it Ryan Gosling?
It is. Yeah, that's a brutal film. Mm. But back to the Fast and Furious. So, Vin Diesel, very, very popular after the first one. But of course, he left. He left the franchise. And he was actually asked to do two Fast and Furious. But he didn't like the script. And so he turned down $25 million, which he would have got doing the movie because he just didn't want to. And I'd expect that Vin Diesel at that time as well, he was like, what did he do, Triple X around that time as well?
That's he had Triple X, Pitch
maybe
Black,
a few other movies, but he wasn't the kind of household name he is now, right? It wasn't quite
the
same stature. It's a big payday for him.
Yeah That's quite a big thing to turn down.
Honestly, I think that he would just do it for the money, right? I had that impression, but fair play to him for actually turning it down.
Well, it's interesting and I'm sorry if this is one of your extra facts, but it's interesting that he did come back for the cameo at the end of Tokyo Drift for the payday, basically, so he could do the next Chronicles of Riddick, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was it. I've got the one in. I'll skip that fact. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Because he wanted funding for that to do
Chronicles of Riddick.
He wanted the rights from Universal. Yeah.
Because that was like a passion project for him.
I mean, fair play. I mean, that's quite a good deal for him, actually. Coming back as a cameo and then getting... I mean, I'm not quite sure how successful Riddick was, but passion project as well.
That one was a flop, but they're making Riddick 4 now, aren't they? So
right. Okay.
Riddick fans out there are happy.
Good.
There are dozens of them.
My next fact is about Tokyo Drift. Where does that one rate for you?
I like Tokyo Drift. Someone we used to work with described it as the worst film ever made, and I've never been able to forgive them. In terms of the series, I think it's quite good. It's a nice palate cleanser. You know, you kind of need it. It's a little... Yeah, it's something a little bit different. And also it introduces Han, who is the coolest character in possibly the whole franchise. Or maybe even any franchise. So,
Okay.
He's always eating crisps, Robin. He's mysterious.
That makes him so cool.
He just loves crisps, and I love crisps too. He's so relatable.
Yeah, sorry, Martin, go on.
No, all good. So the police had big problems dealing with the filming of Tokyo Drift, and actually the city of Tokyo didn't give permits for the film to be filmed there. And so the crew and the cast were being hounded by police every day, and the filming caused the roads to come to a standstill, and a lot of angry citizens in Tokyo were annoyed at the fact that they were filming there. Yeah. And often large crowds would gather to watch the film taking place, and the police would come in and, you know, stop them filming, and it took a lot longer than expected due to the issues with this, you know, not giving these permits to be able to film it. Just pretty crazy to think that they just went ahead and filmed regardless.
I mean, what an insane location to decide, like, yeah, we're gonna block off all these streets in Tokyo.
I know. Crazy.
It's good. Yeah. I enjoy it. I like Tokyo Drift.
And then after Tokyo Drift, which film is a bit of a quiz for you, Alex? Yeah. Which film went to Rio de Janeiro?
Fast Five.
Filmed in Rio. Fast Five. Of course it was Fast Five. They did it.
What?
Were they actually in Rio?
I'm guessing probably not.
No. Rio proved, after number four, they were like, oh, screw this. Rio proved to be too costly to film and too dangerous.
Yeah.
And so most of the scenes that were meant to be shot in Rio, including the favela chase, were filmed in San Juan in Puerto Rico instead.
What? Ah, okay.
And in Atlanta for the street races.
Atlanta.
Yes. Yeah. So they were cheaper and better suited for safety regulations. Yeah. I imagine in some cases they're probably, yeah, just they would be able to get people out of the road, etc. And so, yeah, so they didn't actually film in Rio for the vast majority of the film, especially the car sequences.
That makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, aside from the favela chase and stuff, they use established, like, just to have the establishing shots, and then they're in a room somewhere, so for the most of it, yeah.
True.
Makes sense.
So, Vin Diesel, Luke Hobbs.
Oh, yeah.
As you very well know, of course, in all of the films 200 times. He plays the role pretty well, doesn't he? But
Vin Diesel, so you said Luke Hobbs, which is The Rock's character. Are you talking about?
Sorry. Vin Diesel said about Luke Hobbs, The Rock's character.
Right.
It wasn't written for The Rock.
Oh.
It was written for someone else. Can you guess who that someone else is?
I can have a guess. Is it? I don't know. Is it another wrestler? Someone of the same kind of pedigree, maybe?
No, I'll give you a clue. It's someone who's appeared in a Batman movie.
A Batman movie. Is it Tom Hardy?
Not Tom Hardy. But it is a Tom, right?
It is a Tom. Well, yeah. Or a Tommy. Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones? What?
No, right? How ridiculous would that be?
That is ridiculous.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Having said that, it's not Tommy Lee Jones, but Kurt Russell does come into the films in
Fate
of the Furious. Exactly. So I could imagine the character that he plays could also suit Tommy Lee Jones. But yeah, I can't imagine.
But they're thinking Tommy Lee Jones, the fugitive.
Yes, yeah.
And U.S. Marshals, right?
Yeah. I think it could work, but it'd be just a very different role, right?
Yeah.
It would just be played differently, and it'd be written very differently in terms of how you play it. But yeah.
Can you imagine the Hobbs and Shaw film with Tommy Lee Jones alongside Jason Statham?
That would be bizarre. Bizarre. Yeah. No, I can't. It's the answer.
Be a weird duo.
It'd be strange.
Yeah, Tommy Jones would have been a one and done. There's no way that grumpy man would have come back.
You wouldn't have thought so. I mean, how old is he now as well? He must be mid to late 70s?
Oh, yeah, at least.
Yeah.
He wouldn't sanction Vin Diesel's buffoonery, would he? He just didn't.
Well, I mean, the Rock didn't either, did he?
Yeah, they wouldn't have the issues over, like, screen time or neither of them allowing to be beaten up or whatever it was. What was it? They had to have exactly the same number of lines or something, right?
Well, I thought it was that neither of them could lose, or Vin Diesel couldn't lose a fight.
Yeah.
So that's why there's, like, the ridiculous scene in Fast Five where he beats up The Rock. Well, they get in a fight and they kind of both get some good hits.
It's like
in
a draw.
But it's a draw, even though Vin Diesel is half the size.
ridiculous.
And is it, sorry to interrupt, but is it the end of the sixth film where they have that really weird conversation where they're standing next to each other, like looking past each other? You know, they're shoulder to shoulder. They're kind of like, they're not looking at each other.
I think it was six, yeah. Yeah, I think it would have been. Yeah,
and
I don't think
it
would have been five.
They never share a scene.
And there's a weird, it's kind of like a weird forced perspective shot, isn't it? But
yeah.
I don't think it, the thing is, I think people see it online and they think that they're meant to be looking at each other, but I think they are weirdly looking past each other. It's like some masculine,
oh, no, yeah, they are. They're,
masculine
they're
alpha
past
moment,
each other,
but
yeah.
It's just a really weird framing of those shots.
Well, I think it's just a weird thing to do anyway.
It's a bit weird, yeah.
Yeah.
That's presumably, I like to think, is born out of their intolerance for each other. And like, yeah, get the stunt double in. They're standing next to me. We don't need to see their face. You know?
Yeah. Well, what else was weird about the end of Fast and Furious 6 was the scene where they're chasing the cargo plane.
The immense long runway.
Yes, so they're just going and going and going. Do you know how long the longest runway in the world is?
I vaguely remember this fact, but I don't know how long the longest runway is. No,
the longest runway in the world is 3.4 miles.
Yeah.
Now, according to the stats and figures put forward by Vulture.com, and they've basically calculated that how long the scene is and how fast the cars are going, the runway would have to be 28.86 miles in order to accommodate that scene.
Yeah, that's great.
Almost 10 times longer than the longest runway in the world. So
there's a bit where you're like,
yeah,
why hasn't this plane taken off yet? Or stopped or something? Is it still
something
trying?
Happened? Just something, yeah.
How is it still mid at like half taking off? Yeah.
Well, Fast and Furious 7, all of the cars from Fast and Furious 7, this is a bit of a standalone fact here, but all of the cars were destroyed as soon as they finished filming. And this was apparently to prevent people from buying them and using them, because they didn't want people to go and recreate some of the dangerous scenes that they'd seen in Furious 7. So I mean, you'll be able to tell me more, Alex, about some of the significantly dangerous scenes.
Like
and what
smashing.
People would be trying to recreate.
Like jumping cars through buildings in Dubai. Maybe like getting
that. Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that, kids.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how anyone could even recreate anything in the seventh film, but yeah, interesting.
There we go.
Interesting. Fair there enough. I don't. Is that? Do you think that's kind of standard across all these films? I never actually thought about that. Like, what happens to
the cars
in well, films once they're
Frankie
done?
Frankie Muniz bought the car, didn't he, from the first one? So. I imagine not. And didn't Paul
maybe this
actually
rule,
had...
Maybe this rule was brought in after Frankie Muniz, you know, started
racing.
Oh,
yeah, racing just started going mad.
Started terrorizing the town, yeah.
Exactly.
We can't have another Frankie, no.
But didn't Paul Walker, like, bring along his own cars to film, like, the Nissan Skyline was, like, his car, right?
I think that's
right.
Yeah, I think you might be right there. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I think I've read that somewhere. We're given this fact-gathering mission. Yeah. But that would make sense. You know, I mean, if they're supercharged and actually illegal, I guess. Mm. If they're not roadworthy and they're illegal, then it would make sense to get rid of them.
Sure, yeah.
But anyway, yes, moving on. Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham, they actually filmed a scene. This is after Furious 7, I believe.
Okay.
They filmed a scene where Hobbs and Shaw agreed to stop fighting and team up against Dom. Does this ring any bells?
In Furious 7? No, that doesn't at all.
Okay. Well, I imagine that it wouldn't because the scene was meant to be like a tag at the end of the movie, but it was cut.
Yeah.
And so they saw that the chemistry between Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Statham was really good. And that then spawned the 2019 spin-off.
There we go.
That was, it came from a deleted scene where they did a bit of a screen test and realized actually these guys could work together well.
I like it. I like it.
And then my last fact.
Do you know what, though? That would have been so good if it was actually in the franchise. That would have been such a good twist in that film. That would have been cool. Because I feel like when he's... This is not interesting to anyone listening, but I'm going to push on regardless. I feel like The Rock is at the best in Fast and Furious when he's against Dom and the gang, like when he's trying to catch them.
Yeah.
So I feel like him teaming up with one of the baddies and trying to bring him down, that would have been cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Apologies to the listeners for this episode. Thank you. Please stick around for next week, where normal service will be resumed with way less Fast and Furious talk.
And then my last fact is about Vin Diesel. So when Vin Diesel had his baby girl in 2015, he named her Pauline after Paul Walker.
Oh.
There we go.
That's adorable.
Lovely. Oh, thank you for that, Martin. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know.
You're always indulging.
I hardly knew any of those. That's
good.
Those are good. Good, good. No, thanks. Yeah. Lovely. Yeah, well, I would just like to say, in defense, for anyone who hasn't seen them, they're not just dumb car films. There's some, they're not great. They're not, I'm not an idiot. They're not like amazing films. But there's genuine like heart and soul in some of the early films, and then they just kind of progress into like, it's crazy the transformation that those films go through, I think. And they're
just drive.
They're genuinely entertaining. Like what more do you want out of films?
They know what they are. Yeah.
Yes. No, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some amazing stuff in those films, which is just stuff you'd never see on screen outside of Fast and Furious, and that's worth it.
Yeah.
So, Martin, are you ready to be hopefully challenged by some Blues Brothers facts? But you may know them already. Before we do, though, I swear a little palate cleanser to transition us seamlessly from Fast and Furious to Blues Brothers. I thought we couldn't make an episode like this where we're talking about our film facts without mentioning the one and only Orson Welles.
Oh, okay.
So... most famous film, I would say, probably, is Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane. Yeah.
Either the Paul Masson advert.
And
sadly, actually, at this point, probably the Paul Masson advert is more famous than Citizen Kane. But there's so many fascinating things we could say about Citizen Kane. But one fact that I learned, I didn't know this before, but I've learned this whilst looking up stuff for this episode. And I think it encapsulates what we all love about Orson Welles. Apparently, whilst making Citizen Kane at the age of 23, or 26, actually, never mind. Young man, Orson Welles had some peculiar eating habits. Apparently, he drank 30 cups of coffee a day.
What?
Okay. Yeah, okay. 30 cups of coffee a day and got caffeine poisoning during production.
Wow.
Surprised.
So to recover from this, he switched to drinking tea, believing that making a cup of tea takes longer than coffee, so he would drink fewer cups.
Oh dear.
But actually it didn't make a difference because he had an assistant make all his tea for him, so he just had a constant supply of tea instead of coffee, and he drank so much that his skin changed colour.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
And then in addition to this terrible drinking habit, he also sometimes would forget to eat during the day, as you might do, you know, on a busy film set, and then sit down to have a meal of three steaks to make up for the lost time. And sometimes people wonder why Orson Welles became legendarily large in later life.
I mean, good thing Monster didn't exist when he was around.
Oh, right. Like, yeah, he would be.
Citizen Kane never would have been made.
Man, he would have loved that, wouldn't he? He'd been banging for an energy drink.
He really would. Yeah. Oh. Okay. So on to the Blues Brothers, Martin.
Yes.
As you know, the Blues Brothers are Jake and Elwood Blues, played by Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. But did you know that originally it was going to be called The Return of the Blues Brothers?
Oh, okay. Okay. Is that because it was originally on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
It was Dan Aykroyd wrote the script, but it was the first time he'd written any script of any kind. And he says, he claims himself, he'd never even read a script before. So, I mean, he must have read something for Saturday Night Live,
surely.
But he'd never read a movie script before. And he wrote it all on his own, not knowing how to write movie scripts. And his first draft was 324 pages long.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. As a rough guide to those in the listening who don't know, normally one page equals 1 minute of screen time in a movie. So that's I can't even convert that into minutes. Into hours. That's Lord
five
of the Rings
hours,
like.
5 hours, 24, isn't it? Yeah.
That's a big, big movie. Well, so director John Landis then took that script and cut it down to 150 pages, which is 2.5 hours, which is the film that we get today.
Do you reckon that was... Because he hadn't read a film script before, do you reckon a lot of that was just kind of extra details that you don't put in a film script, like almost prose? Do you think was he writing spoke it out?
I tried to find out what he included, what was in the original script that they cut out, and I couldn't find many details. Except one thing I did find out was that apparently the whole process of getting the band back together was needlessly elaborate, John Landis's words.
I mean, it's quite elaborate in the film, though, right?
It takes up most of the movie, doesn't it?
It's most of the film, yeah.
So, yeah, it took even longer. The costumes, the iconic look of the Blues Brothers was actually taken from the cover of the record House of the Blues by John Lee Hooker, where he wears a suit and trilby and sunglasses.
Oh, that's cool. Didn't know that.
No. And originally for Saturday Night Live, as you said, it originated there. They didn't have any particular sunglasses that they wore. They just grabbed whatever sunglasses they had. But then the costume designer for the film said, no, they have to be Ray-Bans. They have to wear Ray-Bans. Unfortunately, Ray-Bans weren't making those sunglasses anymore. They weren't. They'd gone to kind of thin wire frame stuff at that time in the late 70s. So, John Landis, the director and the costume designer, apparently just raided charity shops. Just going around hours and hours and hours, buying as many Ray-Ban sunglasses as they could find until they found the right kind, because they'd all been out of production for years. And they were out of fashion, so people were just donating them to charity shops.
Yeah, yeah. That's crazy.
So did you know... Well, can you tell me, Martin, how fast the cars were driving in the finale?
Oh, I imagine it's incredibly slow. It's got to be really slow, right?
Yeah, traditional method of driving slowly and they speed up.
Yeah. Did they not do that? They were just really fast.
They were going 110 miles per hour. They were actually...
That's insane.
They were actually driving them that fast.
Wow, that's crazy. It's so dangerous.
Yeah. Incredibly. Did you do you know how many cars they used?
Oh, I know it's a lot. Wasn't it like, is it, I don't know, 80? More than 80?
Interesting point, because the aim was to try to make it look like about 100 cars were piling up, but they couldn't afford that many cars, so they only had 20 cars. And what they would do is they'd crash them, film 20 crashing together, and then they set up, yeah, they set up a workshop, an auto repair shop next to the set, and then they crash all the 20 cars from one angle, repair them all, crash them again from another angle, and just try to make it look like 100 cars.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, it sounds like it worked.
Clever.
They must have been absolute botched jobs, surely. Like,
oh, yeah.
We're repairing them. They've crashed them 3 times already, and now it's like the fourth round of cars. They've just got like sticking plasters on them.
Yeah. John Landis says they destroyed 25 cars by the end of the movie.
That's not too bad going, actually, considering the amount of destruction there is in that film.
That's true.
Yeah. Done well.
So, Martin, can you tell me, if you were a studio executive who had agreed already to fund the Blues Brothers movie, and you've been told by Dan Aykroyd and John Landis and John Belushi that it was going to be about the music that's in the film, featuring the music artists in the film like Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, would you be happy with that? Would you approve that?
Would I approve of having those music stars involved?
Yeah.
Oh, of course. But I imagine they weren't.
you'd be right. They resisted. The studio was not happy with the Blues Brothers movie having rhythm and blues music in it.
That's mad.
What?
That's mad. Because it's so iconic.
They wanted trendy music like disco to be in it.
What were they thinking? Wow.
They was looking for dollar bills, a guaranteed hit. That's what they wanted. But thankfully, they lost that argument.
Why is that such like a common trend or like a thing where it's like the movie studio executives just do the exact wrong thing all the time? Like, it feels like, why is that a thing? Surely they're good at their jobs.
Do you think they think people like music, people like pop music, therefore if people like the music that's in the trailer, they're more likely to come and see the film? Is that their thinking? Like, it's popular.
It's all about marketability. I guess they'd sell the music on the album too, right? And then that would sell more copies, they think.
Well, I've got the Blues Brothers album and I bought it, so...
Well, here's the thing. So it was, as you probably know, it was the movie was kind of sold off the back of the Blues Brothers sketch, which was so successful, they released an album as the Blues Brothers called A Briefcase Full of Blues in 1978, which went double platinum and was number one on the Billboard 200.
Yeah.
And yet the studio was still like, blues music. Nah, we don't want that.
Don't be silly. And also, you think about the legacy as well. And also, to quote, it's about the music, man. Like, it is about the music, isn't it? Like, that's the whole film is about the music. And I mean, they play some different non-blues music, don't they, in order to get people on side.
They do.
So they go to that. They go to that. Dad and a standby. Oh, man. Yeah.
The chicken wire.
Yeah. The bottles smashing through. Yeah. Oh,
that's
interesting.
Oh. So, speaking of the music, a big climactic musical number at the end, John Belushi's character is doing all those cartwheels and flips, backflips.
Yeah.
He is doing them himself, which you may already know.
Yes, yeah.
But did you know he had a knee injury whilst they were filming that?
Right, okay.
So he'd had the knee injury earlier in production, but... still did all the flips and the cartwheels himself.
That's mad.
With an injured knee.
Wow.
Must have been really painful.
Yeah.
It's mad to think that, because he wasn't a small lad at all, was he?
No. Surprisingly athletic for a...
That makes me think, you know the... I don't know how long ago you've seen it, but you know there's the scene in the church?
Yes.
And I've seen the light.
Yeah.
You know, but then they go and see the penguin. I imagine he's doing all the flips in that too.
Yeah, I think so.
Down the aisle.
That was where he hurt his knee.
I think it might be, actually, yeah. Maybe that was how he hurt his knee. But I think he had a secret trick to maintaining his energy levels.
Oh, loved a bit of cocaine, didn't he?
Just a bit. So apparently the film had a budget of $17.5 million, which is pretty big for the time, actually.
Mm.
And they went over budget by $10 million.
And that was the unofficial cocaine budget.
Well, a big part of this was apparently John Belushi. After the first month of production went well, John Belushi started having all-night parties every night, which were mostly just drugs and alcohol, because, to quote John Landis, the director, the cocaine would make him want to drink, and then drinking would make him want to do cocaine. So it would just go round and round. And sometimes these would last for days, these parties, and he would disappear. And one time they lost him, like literally they just lost him on set. Let me find the story. Dan Aykroyd said, "We lost John one night. But it wasn't because he was high. It was because he was hungry. And he didn't like the food that was being served on set. We couldn't find him anywhere. Finally, I saw this path going through a parking lot and into a nearby neighborhood, so I followed it. The neighborhood was all dark except for one house with a light on. I knocked on the door and say, "Excuse me, we're shooting a movie and missing an actor. John Belushi, have you seen him?" And the guy goes, "Oh yeah, Belushi. He came in about an hour ago, raided my fridge, and he's crashed on my couch."
What?
Oh my gosh. That's mad. That is mad. I mean, he was an absolute tear away, wasn't he? In terms of, must have been a nightmare to work with. Like, fantastic, but also a nightmare.
Well, there was, yeah, cocaine was, it was decided at one point, in order to keep Belushi on set, that an unofficial part of the budget was spent on buying cocaine and bringing it to the set to keep him and other crew members who he got hooked on it on location.
That's mad. That is mad.
Why are we not in the movie business?
Probably be dead already.
I just can't get over it. How much of it, like, I mean, is Dan Aykroyd a tracker? Like, how much, what kind of trail was John Belushi leaving behind him for him to follow him to a random
to
house?
To a house. Just, light on.
Maybe he just understood him. Was just like, I think John would just follow this random path, like, and it'll that's such, house with lights on.
That is a classic move of a Ghostbuster, isn't it? That's what Dan Aykroyd would do. Tracks down John Belushi. Wow.
What conspiracy was Dan Aykroyd massive in?
He was a big, he was aliens, oh, basically right? all of them, was but aliens? Yeah, aliens. And he claimed to have seen the Men in Black.
That was the one.
And of course, he sells his own Crystal Skulls vodka, which this podcast is proudly sponsored by. No, we're not. We're not.
Although, apparently, people say it's good, actually. The reviews I have seen of it are quite positive.
Okay. As celebrity alcohol. And he was doing celebrity alcohol before it became popular, I think.
That's true. Yeah.
Before Ryan Reynolds and all of that. So, fair play.
So, did you know that Blues Brothers almost wasn't released and was almost a commercial disaster?
Really?
For the studio. Because obviously they spent nearly $30 million on it, which would be about $98 million today, which is a massive budget for a comedy.
Yeah, mostly on cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
But it was released in fewer than 600 cinemas across America at the time, when there were about, I think, 6,000 or 7,000. And that's not many at all for a movie of this size. Partly because certain major cinema chains, in particular the Mann cinema chain, run by Ted Mann, didn't want to show the film in a lot of their cinemas, particularly in nice areas dominated by white people, because he didn't believe that white people would be interested in a movie full of black music, and he didn't want black people to come into these nice white neighborhoods and start causing trouble.
What?
Sounds like Ted Mann was a bit of a dick.
That sounds a little bit like, the adversaries were very much, it's going to make the Nazis look bad, this film.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Well, to be fair to Ted Mann, he was, when challenged about it, by a journalist, he's on the record as saying, "It's mainly because of the musical artists. Not only are they black, they're out of fashion." Those are his words.
Wow.
So, but it was fine. It was a smash hit in those 600 cinemas, and it expanded pretty rapidly and became one of the highest grossing films of the year, and I believe the highest grossing comedy ever at the time.
Right, okay.
I think $58 million it grossed in America that year. Decent. And internationally, the same again. So
That's
easily made his money back.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, I think that's all the kind of interesting little nuggets. I have one more for you that I forgot to mention earlier, which is about the sunglasses. And you may know this already, actually, but they ended up getting 140 pairs of sunglasses.
From charity shops.
Charity shops, yeah. they had so many that John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd started just giving them away. As they were making the film, and then the number got fewer and fewer and fewer. And one of the people they gave them to was a man called Paul Brickman, who's a director. He visited the set, and Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi gave him 30 pairs of Ray-Bans. Paul Brickman, then went on to direct a film called Risky Business with Tom Cruise,
okay.
who famously wears Ray-Bans in the film
yeah.
and relaunched that entire Ray-Ban brand the following year.
Yeah. Crazy.
You're welcome, Ray-Bans.
So Ray-Bans owe the Blues Brothers quite a lot.
Thank you. No, really interesting. And I didn't know many of those at all, which is great. I think it's even better if you don't in some ways. But no, superb. I'll watch it with a different lens next time I see it. And just forget that Blues Brothers 2000 happened again.
Yeah, I deliberately did not look at Blues Brothers 2000. I didn't want it. What I want to know, though, is how much of Blues Brothers 2000 is maybe the other half of Dan Aykroyd's original Blues Brothers script.
Oh, you know, potentially. I've only seen it once. That's that was enough.
More than enough.
I rented it from Blockbuster back in the day, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that long quality ago. Fare they were purveying. The only films I ever rented from Blockbuster were Inspector Gadget and Batman and Robin.
You mean you rented two films from Blockbuster?
Deprived.
That's so unlike you.
Well, we bought films more than that.
Fair enough.
Or borrowed them from the library. But yes, those.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The pattern is Blockbuster inspired us to rent bad films. That's the.
It was amazing when you went to Blockbuster and you go there and it'd be like, oh, no, this film doesn't have a box, but buy it. It means that it's. All the copies have been rented out. It's like,
yeah.
Well, 50 copies of like Vanilla Sky have been rented out. What the hell? It's amazing how popular it was.
There was something special about that, wasn't it? When you could go there and choose your film for like the weekend, like once a week or once every other week or something. And
yeah, it's a nice little thing to
pick out a film. And
Haven't Netflix just announced they're planning to start opening shops?
I did hear
it. It all
this.
Comes back around, doesn't it? How is that going to work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You go in and like go on iPads and pick what film you're streaming that night when you go home. What is that?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure what they're trying to do.
Hey guys, we've discovered this new technology. Discs.
Maybe it's kind of like how vinyl records had like a kind of resurgence, didn't they? From people who were nostalgic for them. Maybe it's going to be that with Blockbuster.
The only way I could see that properly working is if they go for like really old legacy stuff that a special edition or whatever, and so it does feel a bit more like vinyl. Or if everything in there has an exclusivity window before it actually comes to Netflix. So you're renting something that's going to come to Netflix in like, I don't know, a month's time, but you can go to the Netflix store first and rent it from there.
That could work.
Physical.
I mean, how many people are going to be that diehard though about it?
No,
I feel like that's just, I don't know. I mean, I'd just be happy to wait, I guess, but I don't know. Yeah.
Who knows? Otherwise,
Yeah. Well, are there any other little palate cleansing facts that you might have?
I've got a couple of facts if you'd like.
Oh yeah.
Okay, for Alex.
So one of the most famous iconic films ever made. I'm talking about Jaws. And one of the most iconic lines from this film, I've got an interesting fact about. So pick a line from Jaws. What's the most iconic
line? We're going to need a bigger boat.
You're going to need a bigger boat. Did you know that this was a improvised line?
There we go.
This wasn't even scripted. And actually, it has a kind of interesting story behind it. So You're Gonna Need a Bigger Boat had actually just become a running joke on the set. And it was basically meant to signal whenever like a small mistake happened, it became like a catchphrase for any time anything went wrong on set. So if lunch was running late or like the waves were rocking the camera or something, someone would say, "You're gonna need a bigger boat." Roy Scheider. He ad-libbed the line multiple times throughout the film, but the time he only made it into the film that one time.
That's
cool. I didn't know that. Yeah.
It was originally just an improvised line that came from an inside joke on set.
Fantastic. Well, I've got a fact about Christoph Waltz. Oh. So Christoph Waltz won an Oscar for playing the Jew Hunter in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
But it turns out that Christoph Waltz's first wife was Jewish, and his son is in fact a rabbi.
No way.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I wasn't expecting him to actually be a Nazi in real life. So.
No, isn't that funny, of being the Jew Hunter and your son's a rabbi? I thought it was kind of funny. Interesting.
That must have been awkward watching that film, Family Gathering, I guess, maybe.
Oh, it's so ridiculous.
Getting the family round, oh yeah, look at this film that I just won an Oscar for. And he's just there like, I'm sorry in advance.
It's slightly awkward.
And that first scene with him is so intense as well. It's,
It's also ridiculous though. It's like, oh my God. And then you're like, actually, this is just so stupid. The whole thing is just really, 200 Nazis just through the door. shoots the woman from like 400. Oh, and he doesn't shoot her, does he? Pulls out the pistol.
I love that film. I think that film's great.
Oh, it's great.
It's really good. I haven't watched it for ages. We mentioned Nazis quite a lot in this podcast. It's funny.
Yeah.
And all this.
I don't have any more facts about Nazis in cinema. I've got a fact about Hans Gruber from Die Hard. He's not really a Nazi.
No, he's German, but he's not.
Xenophobia there.
But you know the bit where he's dropped at the end? He falls from the window. Spoiler alert.
Spoilers.
Sorry.
But yes.
But the surprise on his face, it looks like he's got this real look of surprise, is actually genuine, because Alan Rickman was told he'd be dropped after counting down to zero, but they actually dropped him a bit sooner on one. So he wasn't expecting it. It was a bit of a surprise, and I think they did that on purpose, just to capture that on cinema, you know.
It works. Shock. It works. Beautiful. Thank you so much for sticking with us as we recount all these sometimes random, mostly we attempted a theme with favorite movie facts. Hopefully you learned something new, just as we learned something new. But before we go, before we say farewell, we'd like to know the answer to the riddle.
I would very much. I kind of think that Martin's got
it. Yes, please.
So I think it's good.
It's not the most challenging riddle in the world, but just to reiterate it is, the question is, I make two people out of one. What am I? What do you think?
If it's God, I'm going to be really annoyed.
Or a baker with a roll of gingerbread.
Oh, that's great. That's a great one, yeah.
These are much better answers than the real thing.
I make two people out of one.
Is it a
Is it Professor Frankenstein or whatever? Oh, no, he doesn't do that. He makes one person out of multiple people. Yeah, ignore that.
That's the opposite.
That's the opposite.
No, go on, Robin. What is it?
The answer is a mirror.
Oh, that's good. Okay, to me, I make two people out of one. I make two people.
If you're lying, then yeah, that's great. Yeah, that works. It's just not true, but yeah, sure. You don't make two people. Whatever. I get it.
Well,
good one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending this time with us and for listening to us. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and please do tune in for our probable Halloween live quiz on YouTube. Head over to YouTube to join us live for a Halloween quiz, probably after Halloween. Sorry, everyone, but schedules are a thing. But we like to celebrate Halloween and extend it for just a little bit longer.
Oh, yes.
I guess it's worth mentioning as well, if you do want to see us be doing something spooky, check out what we've got on a new channel, which is when we went ghost hunting in York.
Indeed, you do.
It's a
new channel called Uncovered,
which is a brand new, exciting venture that neither of us have ever done before.
There'll be a link in the description below, and maybe a card on screen if you're watching us on YouTube. Please do check it out and enjoy us hunting ghosts in York. Ciao for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.